Episode 293 of the Pilot the Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app.
Aviation, there's a new offer from SiriusXM. Make sure you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your plane by getting the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver. The GDL52 has ADS-B traffic and weather plus SiriusXM weather and entertainment. It has Bluetooth and works with Garmin Pilot apps. For a limited time, you can get a $300 rebate on the GDL52, plus it comes with a free 3-month trial of SiriusXM's weather and entertainment. I love flying with SiriusXM, and it's honestly one of my favorite features about having the G5000, so the GDL52 will offer you a very similar outlook on the weather and also getting to listen to some awesome radio stations on SiriusXM. So check out the GDL52 at aopa.org/SiriusXM.
Hi, everybody. My name is Fred North. I'm what you call an aerial coordinator working for the Hollywood industry, and then we'll go more into details.
AV Nation, what is going on, and welcome back to the Pilot podcast. My name is Justin Seams, and I am your host. Today's episode is one that has been requested for a long time, but we have finally got Fred North on the podcast. You've seen his viral videos 100%. What this guy can do in a helicopter is crazy, and his sense of humor is even better. So buckle up. This is a great episode. It's one that you're definitely not going to want to miss. Share it with all your friends. Share it with everyone. You might want to work in the Hollywood industry and try to be like Fred North, because what he does is pretty cool. And it just goes to show how crazy cool it is, how many different jobs there are within aviation in general. Whether you want to fly for the airlines, fly corporate, you can fly stunts in helicopters in Hollywood, which not many people would have ever thought of, but here we are. So Fred, thank you for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it. If you guys like the Pilot to Pilot hats, go to boldaviator.com, search Pilot to Pilot. You can find the hats there, the best hats in the game. I promise you, you won't regret it. But Aviation, I want to keep you much longer. Without any further ado, here is Fred North. Fred, what's going on? Welcome to the Pilot to Pilot podcast.
Thank you so much. Pilot to Pilot. I love that. Are you a pilot, by the way?
Yeah. I'm a corporate pilot. So I fly Citation Latitude. I just actually looked at my logbook the other day. I have like 5,700 hours, I think.
That's pretty good.
A little bit of flying. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
But we'll talk a little bit about it. What do you say?
You're getting there.
Yeah. How many hours do you have?
Just a bit over 21,000.
Oh, dang. Yeah, that's a lot. How many do you have when you're 33? That's a better question.
You know, did you get my book?
No, they never sent me your book.
Well, you need to get one, because the reason I'm saying that is because I use my 13 notebooks that I have, because I have paper book. And at the beginning of each chapter, there's the flying hours. So if you read the book, you're going to know how many hours I had at 33.
That's awesome. That's actually really smart. I like that idea. If I ever write a book, I'm going to steal that.
Yeah. The book is really fun. It's a crazy journey, and it's called Flying Sideways. And it's a fun book. And at the end of the book, you have some QR codes and you can use your phone, and the story that I'm telling, then you can put your phone and then watch the video of what I'm writing.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right. After this, I'll buy the book. I got to get it. So
some crazy helicopter story, but there's also plane stuff. It's fun.
Well, cool. Well, let's go ahead and get started. Let's dig in. First question I ask everyone is why aviation? Was there just an initial longing looking up, seeing airplanes? I was like, dang, Fred wants to do that. Or was it just kind of a spur of the moment? I'm going to go fly.
So my parents are teachers, were teachers. So absolutely not, you know, French teachers. And I'm born and raised in Africa. So no helicopters, no aviation, not close to an airport. Nothing in my family was aviation. But when I was 8 years old, I was living in West Africa, in Senegal. And then I was in the street. I'm 8 years old. And there's a helicopter that flew above my house. And then he landed in the soccer field that is close to us. And it's a soccer field that was no grass. It was a sandy soccer field. So when he landed and I was there, the sand, the wind, the noise, the electrifying moment, basically is like, whoa. To me, as 8 years old living in Africa, it was like an alien ship because there was no cell phone, there was no TV. You have to understand it, you know, from my perspective at the time, it's like, this is a vessel, like this is an alien ship. And the helicopter landed, there were no doors, and it was like a 5-seaters. And then the guy that got out of it was my teacher of like social study or something like that at the time. And then he had cameras around his neck like that. And then, sorry. And then he was going to do some pictures of the main river that was bursting into the ocean. So then he said, do you want to come with me? And you have to understand that this is in 1969. Okay. So there was no doors and no seatbelts. I'm 8 years old. He's putting me in the back. There's 3 seats in the back. No doors, no seatbelts. Who gives a shit at the time? He put the guy, me, 8 years old, by myself, in the back with no doors and no seatbelts. And I'm holding the seats. And then we go for a flight. And then when they do turns, I'm thinking I'm going to fall. You know, you're 8 years old. So I'm holding like a crazy guy. And anyway, I do that flying and then I land everything. So that day, like I was like sold on it. So that was my first interaction. And then you have to go fast forward all the way when I'm 20 years old. I'm in the army in France and then I work with helicopter and then everything came back to my mind. And then that's when I decided to be a pilot. You know,
when you had that first interaction, was there any kind of, you mentioned later, it took a little bit of time before you realized that you wanted to be a pilot. So when you went in the helicopter the first time you got out, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go fly that. That was really cool. That'll probably never happen again. Was that kind of your mindset?
Well, the first time I was 8 years old. So, you know, you don't even ask yourself those questions. It was like, I was in an alien vessel. Like to me, and also you have to understand that that helicopter was an Alouette 2. I don't know. It's like a Mad Max helicopter. So it was not like a fancy Gusta, you know, it was not a fancy VIP machine. It was like a rough Mad Max machine, which added to the emotion that I had that day. But it was very deep in my mind. My mother told me I was drawing helicopters all the time. So it was there. But it was not like I didn't think about it. It was just there. And then when I went to the army and I had to do some rescue stuff, I was on the ground, but I had to work and interact with helicopters. That's when I said, this is what I want to do, you know, to be a helicopter pilot.
So what was 8-year-old Fred North's dream kind of when you're playing on a soccer field? Was it to keep playing soccer? Did you have any other kind of dreams or goals that you had in your mind then? I mean, I know an 8-year-old, how many dreams and goals do you actually have?
Because my parents were teachers, I wanted to be a gym teacher for a long time. And then they told me there's no really a future in it, those things. And then rapidly, I wanted to be a stunt in the movies, you know, nothing to do with the flying part. And then when I went to the army and I worked with helicopter, that's what I said, you know, I really want to be a helicopter pilot. It was not, at the time, it was not aviation. It was the helicopter part of it that was interesting me.
What was the timeline for you or kind of the reason behind going into the army? Was it mandatory? Was it something you always wanted to do? Talk a little bit about that.
So my parents, so I was very bad at school. So didn't go to college. I was shit at school. Like you can't even think of. Was not my thing. Okay. So they didn't know what to do with me. And you have to understand, my parents were more academic. They were like teachers and smart teachers. So I was like a loser, you know, they didn't know what to do with me. So they said, you're going to go to the army. So I signed a contract for 5 years with the French army. But before I go there, and all I'm telling you here, it's in the book, but it's in a funny way. I'm telling all those stories. Before going to the French army, I tried to be a jet fighter pilot and I went to do 1 week of a selection. So I'm sure it's the same in the US where you can go and to see if you can be a candidate for to be a potential jet fighter pilot. So I went to a place south of Paris 1 week. And for 1 week, they do a lot of testing to be a jet fighter pilot. So after the 5 days, so that's with the French Air Force. So I do the 5 days. After the 5 days, to me, the way I saw it, I was 18, okay? I thought, I'm going to be the best motherfucker jet fighter pilot ever. Like I thought all the testing were fantastic. I was feeling good with myself, you know. Then I go to in front of that guy. He's like a general, like a high rank. And he was the one to make decision on who will be admitted to the program. And then it was a Friday, like 5 PM. I remember all my life. That guy is facing it. You have to understand he's representing like a huge, you know, weight for me, because he's the one saying if you're going to be a jet fighter pilot or not. And then he said, you know, Fred, I wanted to tell you. And when he said that, I thought he was going to say you were the best of the school, you know, all that stuff. And he said, you will never be a good pilot. You will never be a pilot. You should not even think about it and go do something else. So that was harsh, like a slap in the face, like you can't even imagine. You're 18, and then that guy says that. Okay. And it took me like a month or two to recover from that, because I was so depressed and I thought that was it. I'm done. What I did not understand at the time is he was telling me no. He was not saying, in fact, he told me I will never be a good pilot, but he said he wanted to mean is you will never be a good military jet fighter pilot. But he never said that. So I understand now at my age and with my experience, I know when somebody says no to you, he never says no for you. He say no for him. Okay, so you have to make sure that you don't take that as a no necessarily, because he doesn't know my life. He didn't know really who I am. That guy was the first time I met. Okay, he would just took a bunch of testing, and then and my main issues was lack of discipline. Like I didn't really like somebody tell me what to do and something stupid. So all the testing that I did with their military shrink didn't go well. But he basically, that's why he said that. But I took it personally as a pilot. So look, I'm just saying for the audience, it's not because somebody says no to you that he says no because of you. He's saying that because of them. So don't take it the wrong way, because it took me a while. So after that event, and when I went to the army, but the French army, not the Air Force, and then when I had the connection with the helicopter, that's when I became a deserter. Deserter, in you say, okay, because I left the army because I was not supposed to. I signed a 5-year contract. So in the book, I'm explaining the whole thing, how they put me in prison, they do all that stuff. And at the end, they signed my release. But it took a little while. I was a wildcat because I wanted to do the helicopter pilot lesson and stuff. And then I did that. And then it was complicated to do my license, but that's how it played.
What was the reason for wanting to get out of the military? Was it, has it have to go back to you not liking people to tell you what to do? Or was it kind of
that, but it was not just that. It because I was the problem in France back then, and maybe it's the same in the US, but if you sign a contract with the army, you have to stay where you are. You can't change from the army to the Air Force or to the Navy. You stuck where you are. And when I asked them, can I go to the helicopter army division? They said, no, you are, I was mountains and rescue team because I was a good skiers and I loved the mountains and climbing, all that stuff. So I was in Chamonix, which is in France, mountains, one of the highest peak in Europe. And so anyway, they said no. So because they said no, I figured I have to get out of the army and then do it in the civilian world. That's what.
So how'd you get out? I mean, I know you said you deserted, but like, what did you do? Just run away? Did you in the middle of the night?
I went to New York on vacation to see my girlfriend and I stayed there. You know, I was supposed to be gone for 1 week and I stayed for like 2 months. And then when I came back, the problem is I came back the wrong way. So instead to come discreetly, you know, and they would have got me, but I mean, instead to, I didn't do it, you know, you should read the book because I explaining how I did it, but long story short, because I came from New York as a French guy, I came with all the cliche, the American cliche that you can have as a French person looking at America. Back then, you have to understand that's in the 80s and stuff. And I came back with rollerblades, had a yellow Sony, you know, the speakers, the two speakers, handheld thing, the yellow one, the Sony that was super famous back in the days. So I had it on my shoulder with my backpack. And I was rolling and I went inside the base. The problem was it was 8 a.m. in the morning and there were all the soldiers, you know, doing a flag thing where you do the salute, the flag in the morning. So when I came like that, that didn't go well. So they put me in prison directly. I even didn't go to my room. So anyway.
Did you ever think about to stay in the United States? Just be like, let's stay here as long as I can. They can't arrest me here.
I wanted to do that, but I didn't have a visa. It was, my English was like your Chinese, maybe, like really
not very good.
Sucks. Yeah, no good. Yeah. So
I got ni hao and xie xie.
Right. But it was about good morning and have a nice day, you know, that's it. So it was, you know, of course I could have, but I was not mentally, I didn't have money. It was like, you know, so no. So then I had to leave the army and then do it in France and then, you know, did some crazy work job to find the money to do my lessons.
So, all right, you are, you officially, well, let's say you clear your name, you deserted the army, you're yeah. doing your own thing now.
Yeah.
Helicopters was all that was on your mind, right? Like, yeah. It's like, I want to fly helicopters. That's all I want to do.
Yeah.
So did you stay in France to do that? Did yes. you come back to the States? Okay. So you stayed in France
to do that.
You mentioned you had no money. So what'd you do for money? Did you just work all the jobs?
So my girlfriend gave me a little bit of money. My parents gave me a little bit. So my girlfriend gave me the most. My parents gave me what they gave to the other, my siblings, because I have a twin sister, another a smaller brother and a bigger sister. So they gave me, you know, like the equivalent of $5,000 basically at the time. And then my girlfriend gave me like $30,000. That was the biggest chunk. And with that money, I bought a used car that had like a little damage from insurance company and old garage, like shop. And I fixed the cars and then I sold them with a profit. And I did that for like 8 months. And then with the $35,000, I made it to $60,000. And then I had enough money to pay for my lesson because I didn't want to stop in the middle and not be able to keep going. So I went to there was a heliport in Paris, and I went to that company called Heli France. And at the time they were the helicopter company in Paris, and they had a shuttle that was going from like if you're in LAX to the city or like JFK to New York. So they had that in Paris. And I told the CEO of that company, I said, I will do anything to be able to learn in your company, to be a pilot in, you know, in your company. He told me, but you don't even exist. Like I don't hire pilots unless you're 2000 hours. I said, I'll do anything. So then he said, okay, you can work for, you know, as a ground crew at the local airport. And if you want, you can come back every day, do 6 minutes of flying each time. So I'm not going to pay you, but you can do 6 minutes. Very generous. So then I worked 10 hours a day. I was doing 6 minutes in the morning and 6 minutes at the end of the day in the helicopter flying with the guy. And I was telling people where to go to the bathroom. I was carrying the luggage. I was driving the van. So I did that for 6 months. And they saw that I was really a hard worker person. Then they said, okay, we can teach you. So that they didn't have a school. So they bought a helicopter for the school. They started a program with me basically because they were only doing VIP charters and stuff like that. So they bought a crappy Enstrom helicopter, like a small one that was really not easy to fly. So I started with them. I did my commercial license with them. And then the CEO told me, Fred, now get out. I said, but you told me I can fly with you. But he said, you have 150 hours. You need to have like at least 1,000 hours to come back to me. I was devastated because in my mind, I was going to go, you know, the stupid dream thinking is going to work out. So then I had to work for other company, like shitty company, like crappy helicopters. I had engine failures, gearbox failures, plenty of stuff. But I built up my hours. And then after I had 1,000 hours to the dot, I came back to that guy and I said, that's it. Now you hire me. And then he said, well, you need a bit more hours. I said, no, you promised me. So then he hired me. And then I worked with them for a couple of years. And then I kept, you know, flying with other people.
When you finally got the job, was it kind of a big sigh of relief where you're like, man, I finally made it. This is my job. I did it.
No, I mean, it was amazing. I mean, you know, for the first solo flight, it's like if I'm telling you, you're going to go to the shuttle to go to space tomorrow. I mean, for me, it was everything. My first job, I was flying in a Bell 47. So the bubble, like a really piston helicopter, they were paying me $1,000 a month. But I was so happy. Like, I do not give a shit about the money. You know, the guy was abusing, you know, me, I mean, as far as the salary. But I was so happy I didn't give a crap. I was the most happy, like the happiest guy in the world. So it was fantastic. Yeah, super happy.
When someone gives you money, especially like a large chunk of change, Do you feel kind of like forever indebted to them? Like in the back of your mind, did that help push you to continue your training, continue down this path? Even still today, do you still like think about that and how thankful you are for receiving, you know, the equivalent of 30 grand? That's a lot of money. How did that kind of play in your mentality?
No, I gave back all the money. I mean, to my parents, no, because my parents, but my girlfriend, yes. I mean, in fact, because we got married and then we divorced later because she slept with my best friend, she took way more than she gave me, trust me. So that was all good there. So there was no problem there. Because she also did that with my best friend in my bed. So she took my bed, my house, my thing. So, but anyway, forget that little piece. And in the book also, I'm saying a lot of that stuff. But anyway, it's more funny than anything else. But no, I didn't. I don't like to owe money to anyone. So yeah, I'm not a kind of person that... if for a reason I borrow, which I never do, but for anything, then I'll make it up to you 1,000%, you know?
Yeah. It's tough getting the money. I mean, that's been one of the biggest kind of cost entry, right? Or prohibits people getting in is the money. And you have to essentially, there's multiple ways to do it, whether it's loans, whether you're lucky enough to have someone lend you the money, a family member or a girlfriend.
Yeah, to find a way. But to me, each time I hear people saying, you know, money is an issue, I say, you should not see it as an issue. Okay. It's a way for you to go to get things. So try to make the effort to get that way. You know, because when you say money, often it's like, oh, you know, I need the money for this, I need money for that. But if it's not your license, it's going to be a house, it's going to be a car, it's a mean to get something, and it's going to be there all your life anyway. I want a bigger helicopter. I need this. I need to go business class ticket somewhere. It's always the money part, but you'll find a way. You know, we all do.
Yeah, and one thing to think about it too is, this is kind of like an investment, right? You're investing in yourself. It's education. It's a way for you to make money down the line. Yeah. So whether you're sacrificing right now, taking out a loan or getting the money and working two jobs,
right,
it's a temporary suck for you to do what you want to do eventually and make aviation.
Yes, you need a little bit of pain to get what you want and be happy about it. I mean, if there's no pain, I mean, a little bit of difficulties, there's no achievement.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to have a lot of joy in your career when you haven't had to earn it, right? you got to roll up your sleeves eventually. You got to get arrested in a French prison eventually, right?
In aviation, though, we do. Everybody goes through that same, you know, complication at the beginning.
You're talking about your first couple jobs and you're talking about engine failures, gearbox failures. I had an engine failure in a 206 when I was doing aerial photography in a Cessna 206. It sucks, right? It's kind of part of building your hours, at least it was part of building your hours until now, where you can have 1500 hours, get hired at an airline, fly like a 777, which is crazy to me. But building your hours used to be like a life or death thing. Like, I mean, it's kind of exaggeration, but some of these planes, you never knew what was going to happen after you took off.
1,000%.
So talk a little bit about kind of the mentality of building your hours, especially coming from an engine failure, rewind your brain, be like, all right, that's not going to happen again. And then you have another one. And then kind of talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, when you're a young pilot and then you're like a whore. You're ready to go with anyone. It doesn't matter who that is. You're going to go with whatever's presenting to you. So that Bell 47 that I was flying, he was a wreck. The guy that was owning that machine, on the dashboard, there's those little warning light, you know, caution lights. So he unscrewed them and he removed the bulb and he put them back. Now, my mistake, I was not checking them one by one when I'm supposed to check if they're working. But when I had the engine failure, the light never came on because there was no fucking bulb in there. So just to tell you the guy how he was. So there was no maintenance on the machine. So that's why I had problems on that machine like crazy. But it didn't matter at the time because it was such a happiness, you know, to fly that machine. And the Bell 47, if you see what it is, that bubble with the tail that is, you know, like tubes in the back, it's a Mad Max machine. You know, you connect with that machine because it's a man's machine. Like there's oil everywhere, you know, it looks like a bee, you know, so when I had the failure, I managed the failure. I landed safely and I had passengers with me. I was doing tours, And the guy that was with me, in fact, had no legs. He was a handicapped guy that we put in the machine. And then his daughter was with him. And he had a tractor accident 5 years before going with me. And when the engine stopped, and then I started to do my auto rotation, he gave me a big thing like that and said, don't worry, kid, you know, it'll be fine. And I said, yeah, of course. But he had so much confidence because of, I guess, what his experience was. But then I landed in that muddy field, straight and level, no problem, no damage to the chopper. It was more like the 6 hours to try to find somebody to get my guy that could not walk. That was more the issue and everything else. But when I got the gearbox failure, to me, I knew I had all those issues because the machine were not maintained properly. I had full confidence that a proper maintained helicopter would be fine. But that's when I learned that if I need to know my emergency procedures and all the, you know, training had to be done properly, because each time I was able to manage the emergency because I was properly trained for it. So I was just thinking I need to be on top of my game, you know.
Absolutely. And then you're working these jobs, you come back, you go, hey, I got 1,000 hours. You essentially forced the guy to hire you, which you did.
Yes.
How long, you said you were there for 5 years?
Yeah. A bit less than that. I was maybe 3 years there, and then I went to another job.
Did you think that was going to be your last job? Or like when you showed up with 1,000 hours, you know? Okay, so it was going to be another stepping stone to what you wanted to do.
I had no agenda whatsoever. I just wanted to fly helicopters. I wanted to expose myself to complication. I wanted to go in the mountains. I wanted to go to the desert. I wanted to just fly everywhere. In my mind, I was not going to be based in one place like some helicopter pilots do. You know, because a helicopter pilot is more localized, like in one place, and then you just work in those mountains, let's say. You as a jet pilot, you can go to Abu Dhabi, you can go to this, you can go to that. So you're not, you know, even if you live in Orlando, it doesn't mean you're not flying to China. So as a helicopter, it's different. But so to me, it was going to be global, but I had no plan. I was just going as it goes. And each time I was starting to get comfortable, then I wanted to move on, you know. Yeah.
Shake things up a little bit,
that's
right?
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you do? Did you look for another job? Did you, someone come job hunt you? How did you eventually move on from that job?
No, I always went on a fishing expedition. After that job in Paris, I went to South of France and I wanted to do long line. I wanted to do long line and I wanted to work in the mountains. So I went in the South of France where the Alps are, the French mountains over there, they're pretty high and they go to 14, 15,000 feet. So pretty high. And it's like steep and, you know, it's cliff. It's not like a roundy mountain. It's like scary as hell. So I went there and I started to do long line, and then long line, in the book, you laugh your ass off. So in fact, before I go there, when I was in Paris, the chief pilot told me one day, Fred, there's one guy, he's sick. He's not there. You need to go. And you have to understand, it's in the '80s. So it's not the same than today. And back then in France, that helicopter company was taking Santa Claus for Christmas and then putting the Santa Claus to the school. So we're picking up the Santa Claus under the helicopter on the line, and then we're dropping the dude in the school with all the kids watching, okay, Santa Claus. So I was not supposed to do that. I was not trained to do that. So the Santa Claus story is pretty hilarious today. It was not hilarious back then. But there was so basically we're picking up the guy on the outside of the school, and all the kids, you know, 4 to 10 years old, you know, a couple of hundreds were there waiting for Santa Claus. The wall was maybe 15 feet up around the school. So pick up the dude 300 yards from that wall. I never done that. So I don't have a mirror. I don't know how. So I'm looking down and I have no clue about the depth. There's nobody at the radio to give me anything. Long story short, I lift up the guy and then I go up above the wall, but the guy is going to hit the damn wall. Like there's no way he's going to pass. So people can see him trying to climb because he can see the wall is coming his way. And then the poor Santa Claus slammed into the wall. Luckily, I was not going fast, but he hit the wall. But worst of the worst, I keep going, which means he's being dragged above the wall. And then I drop the Santa Claus and you can see he's not in good shape in front of those kids. So they're traumatized for life because Santa Claus now is a wreck. They will never be a helicopter pilot, those guys. ever, oh, I guess. Gosh. So anyway, that's a Santa Claus story. It's in the book and it's funny as hilarious right now. But it took me a while to recover because it's like I really hurt a Santa Claus. You know, it's not good for the resume.
That's hilarious.
So anyway,
No, keep going.
That was one thing. And then I decided I wanted to be a long line pilot because come on. So then, look, they didn't do anything bad to me at the time because it was my fault, but I should not have done that job. I should have been under supervision. I should have somebody to tell me how to do it, even if it's my fault. You know, if it was today, I would say, well, I'm not qualified. I can't do it. But back in the days, you know, you said, shut the fuck up, go. Sure, I'm going to go. So anyway, I went to the south of France and I did long line. And something else happened there. I kind of started the long line program, but it was just the beginning of it. And again, one pilot was sick and they asked me to go drop a swimming pool. Back then in France, we had those big fiber swimming pool that you could drop. I'm sure they may still do it today with cranes and stuff. But so because of the downwash, you have to take them from a truck and they're upside down. You lift them up sideways and then you take them sideways and you put them in the pit and then you put them down. So, but it's a 300 feet line because you have to be very far from the pool so the downwash doesn't create a problem. That day was a windy as hell. Again, the chief pilot tell me you're gonna go drop that pool, but I never done that. And the company back then told them, you know, it's pretty windy. We would prefer to reschedule. To drop your pool. And the guys, the owner of the house said, no, I really want to do it. You know, all my work is ready. The guy was insisting. So I guess the chief pilot said, Fred, you're going to go do that. It was a windy day. Never done that. 300 feet line. It's very far from you. Really, really far. The helicopter is shaking as hell. It took me like 15 minutes to pick up the pool. Then I'm getting, so that house was on a slope. And it was a one-story house with a lot of windows in the front and the pool was, of course, in front of the house. If that guy wanted like a moving company to empty his house for all the furniture, he should have called me that day because I took care of it properly. So what happened is the pool came close to the house, went inside the house, destroyed all the pillars, went inside the house and basically got out of the house with everything in there. I destroyed the house, the roof of the house collapsed it. It was a disaster. And then after that event, because I didn't know what to do, because now I can't even drop the pool because I'm so scared as hell. It's like, it took me 45 minutes to drop the pool back to the truck. Horrible. So anyway, I'm just telling that because people think that I'm like the Hollywood stunt pilot, that I know my shit. Of course I do, but I had to learn the hard way. It was not easy to do. So in the book, there's plenty of story like that. That is so funny now, right?
I'm dying. Yeah.
And I had, you know, I had to pay my dues. Let's put it that way, you know.
I mean, that's good to know, right? Like everyone on Instagram or in seeing Hollywood, you see a highlight reel, right? You see what you're doing right now. What they don't see is that. They don't see you almost killing Santa Claus.
Yeah,
they right. don't see kind of the struggles.
Yeah.
Or they just think it's all great. They think that you're just the best pilot and you never had anything bad
Correct.
Happen. And they experience one failure and they just completely just don't know how to come across that or battle that adversity.
Yeah.
But let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. Hey guys, Justin here. Did you know that more than 55% of adults don't protect their income with disability insurance? And for pilots like us, with fixed career limits and higher job risk, there's even more riding on missed benefits opportunities than most. But you can take control and full advantage of all valuable benefits your airline offers, starting with free benefit analysis from my partners at RAA. With your free benefits analysis, an advisor specializing in your airline's benefits plan will help tailor an election strategy that best fits your personal needs and goals, including retirement savings, investments, health savings accounts, healthcare and disability coverage, and more. Listen, your benefits aren't just protecting your health. They're critical to protecting your long-term wealth too. But open enrollment is approaching fast and only lasts for a limited time, just like this free benefits analysis offer. So don't wait. Schedule your free benefit analysis today at raa.com/pilot to pilot. That's raa.com/pilot to pilot. Now back to today's episode. Everyone battles adversity. Some people destroy homes. Some people have engine failures. It's just something part of the industry.
And I think if you don't go through those things, you're going to be more dangerous, I think, because because, you know, I understand consequences and liabilities, and I understand that my actions are so important. Like I can make a life difference. It's the same for you. You carry passengers, all that stuff. So we carry a heavy weight on our shoulder, you know, the consequences of our action. But the problem is when you do your training, it's only words. You know, you have to experience it. And I don't wish anyone to experience that. Luckily for me, it was non, you know, life-threatening event, but I had some close call in my life. And even today, when I do my stunt stuff and everything, it's still a heavy weight to carry, you know?
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, the farther you get in your career, right, the stakes just get higher, right? Like, yeah. I mean, for you, it was the house, it was Santa Claus, yeah. And now it's actors.
No, you're right.
Movie sets. Yeah. Yeah.
So I can't, you know, I have to be so careful, and we prep so much when we do stunt stuff, and we're so careful the way we structure the job to try to minimize the risk, and because the risk is there. So we don't deny that it's there. So how do we manage the risk? That's basically aviation, right? Because as soon as we go off the ground, that's it. Risk is there. So how we manage the risk, how we structure the risk, how we reduce it as much as possible, and then we deal with it, you know. But that's, I think it's a heavy load for any pilots out there. And I think the people that never had issues or never had to struggle with, I think it's more complicated for them, because I don't think they realize, you know, sometimes how responsible they can be, you know.
Yeah. And I feel like there's always the kind of like something's going to happen eventually, right? So if you get a couple of things out of the way, you get a little bit more comfortable. You're like, well, I handled that, so I can handle something else.
Yeah.
But if you don't ever have anything, you might, like, in the back of your mind, you might just be thinking like, all right, something's got to happen soon. So I don't know. Yeah. I see both sides. Like, you want to be the best pilot ever and you don't ever want anything to happen, but you learn from those things and you just become a better pilot.
No,
you learn from bad people, yeah. Other people's mistakes, your mistakes, et cetera.
And like you say, you know, eventually you'll get something. We all get something. You know, all the old timer guys like me, you know, in my 21,000 hours, there's so many things that happen. I was, you know, lucky enough that, you know, nothing happened, like really dramatic, but it was also lucky, you know. I manage each time, but, you know, such a small thing could have made a difference, you know. So
how long do those kind of close calls or those bad moments in aviation, how long do they stick with you personally, mentally? Like, after they happen, is it immediately just get out of your brain and kind of don't think about it again? Or the next time you're flying, is it in the back of your mind making you anxious about the flight?
So each time I had a close call or I did something, you know, I did a mistake and then something happened, I immediately went back to flying a few minutes after that or as soon as I could, like the next day, to flush it out. That was the first thing. And then after that, it was very important for me to blame myself. Like I made a mistake. Okay. It's my fault. Okay. Not trying to find excuses. Like so what did I do wrong that took me to this incident? Or because if you don't admit to have made the mistake, it's very hard for you to evolve from that. If you're blaming somebody else, your ego, you know, so you have to make sure that your ego doesn't control that part, because you need to have ego to have confidence in aviation. So that's why sometimes a lot of pilots are, the very good pilots out there, that have an ego so big that they are not friendly, you know, because they think they're so fucking badass or whatever. So I'm really careful to not be like this. Even if you need the ego to build your confidence, you don't want the bad ego. So when something happened like that, don't let the bad ego driving the event. So I wanted to make sure that it's my fault. So, okay, what should I have done different? How I should handle it? When did I make the mistake? What should I do better? Sometimes it's not a direct mistake that led to the issue, but somehow in that chain of event, to a point I made the decision to go this direction or this direction, you know. So I go through that, and then I try to go through the motion of everything that happened in details so I can then forget about it. But I need to go through that. So that took me a few months, because it's always a heavy thing for me to carry. Like I really hate that stuff. And each time something happened, which is, it's rare, but when something happened, even if it's a close call for something, even sometimes if it's not directly related to me, it can be a stunt guy that there's a wrong timing. It's not a mistake on his part. It's just a wrong timing, which is easy, hard to get sometimes. So when we did the Extraction 2 movie, I don't know if you watched it on Netflix, I land on a moving train, and there's five guys that get out at 60 miles an hour, and five guys get out. And one we were doing the training, there's a time where the fifth guy, that was the last one in the helicopter to get out on the train, he for a reason. So what happened is, because when I was on the train with one skid on the train, I could not look in front of me because there were some trees coming up. So somebody was telling me when I had to go, because I had 22 seconds to do the gag, because there was trees at the beginning and trees at the end. So I was not looking there because I had to look at the train because I was landing on it. They were telling me when the last guy was out and when I could go, because they wanted like a sexy, you know, like leaving like a badass. And the guy that was giving me the action to go told me to go when four guys were out, not five. But what happened is, because I was already one skid off the train, I was already on the way. So when he told me to go, I felt there was one more guy there, but I was already on my way out. At this point, there was no way for me to stop. When we did the training, I told that guy, I told all the stuntmen, when you're going to make the decision to get out of the helicopter, it's up to you. Like, you have to commit or stay on board. But if I'm going and then you're in between, it's your call. At that point, I can't stop. I have 2 5 tons machine going off. I'm gone.
Yeah,
that guy, he decided to keep going because he has 1 foot on, there was a bench on the side of the helicopter. So he got on the bench and then he had to jump on the train. When I left, he was still on the bench. So now I'm going this way. And then he went off. He went 15 feet up in the air. But we're going 60 miles an hour on the train. The train is only 8 feet wide, huh? And he landed right on the middle of the train. And we put nets on each side, little nets, just in case one of the stunt was falling off. He stayed in the middle. But what I mean is, so there was a communication issue. The guy, my guy, thought he was five guy, but it was four. So, you know, there's always something. But even if, so everything went well, not a problem, but it could have been bad. Because if he would have jumped like half a second later, he would have jumped on the track and, you know, would have been super bad. So it's not easy what I do as a stunt film pilot.
Definitely not. But I don't think anyone would ever assume that what you do.
No, but sometimes social media people assume that, oh, you know, that guy can do anything, that kind of stuff. It's not like that, you know.
So it's kind of like get caught up to where you are today. How did you get into this? I know that kind of, you sound like the kind of guy that like, opportunities come calling to you and you kind of decipher like if that sounds fun to you or not, right? Will that bring you joy? It's probably not about money to you at all. You probably just love flying if I can call it correctly, like you said. So how did this even opportunity come up? Like what was someone like, I know the perfect guy for you. He's in France. You need to get him right now. Like what, tell me about that story.
So first of all, for something to say, opportunities come to you. So to me, in fact, it's the reverse. I think before I explain, you know, how I got from, you know, Africa to France and to Hollywood business, to be successful as a pilot or anything, in fact, in life, I believe that you have to expose yourself. And how you do that? Okay, you have to travel. When I say travel, you can go from your house to another city. You don't have to go to China, but you like, go outside of your circle, go meet people, do a dance class, do whatever you want to do. Go to a club, aviation club, where the airport is close to you. Go say hi. Just go share experience. Talk to the pilots. So just expose yourself, because if you do that, opportunities will come your way. If you don't expose yourself, nothing is going to happen. So you're the only person that can make opportunities come to you. But for that reason, you have to expose. So why I'm saying that, because that's the way I do things. So when I was flying in France, after all those Santa Claus and little story I told you, I learned long line. I've done a lot of search and rescue, and I became a more comfortable pilot, you know, not destroying Santa Claus anymore. And I did a lot of like the Barra race that you have in the US, but called the Paris-Dakar, which is like a Barra race, but all over Africa. And with the helicopters, I was filming those race. And I started to do it for the TV industry. So the TV industry is not the movie industry. It's two different things. It took me a long time to understand that the difference as a pilot to work for the TV industry versus the film industry is as a TV, the TV industry, when you fly as a helicopter pilot for even a fixed wing, if you're filming an event like a Formula One race or a Barra race, it's not that much the way you're shooting it. It's make sure you're going to shoot the finish line, who's starting, who is ending. They want to know what's going on the ground because that's what matters. Of course, if you get a beautiful sunset, they're going to say fantastic, but don't get the beautiful sunset and not get the car that is finishing the race. So that's TV business, which means there is not a lot of creative part. You have to fill up the contract because that they need to know who is number 89, shoot number 5, make sure you get number 6 finishing the line. So I did that for a few years without understanding really those things. And then one day I did a movie in Venezuela with a director of photography, the guy that did Top Gun, the first Top Gun. And that guy explained to me, the reason I went in Venezuela is because exactly what you said. They wanted, they had a helicopter in Venezuela that's just been bought from a French company in Venezuela. And the registration was a French registration. So they needed a pilot that had the French license to fly that French registered aircraft. They did their homework and they find out that I was the guy in France at the time to hire. So they call me and they say, would you want to come to Venezuela to shoot our film? And I said, but I'm not part of the helicopter company because back then, even today, if you go to a helicopter company, you get a pilot with it. I said, no, but there is a job in the US called a phone pilot and you'll be basically a phone pilot hired by production. I said, really? There is a job as phone pilot? Like you just yourself? He said, yes. I said, that's unbelievable. But I said, how many are there? He said, there is like 5 in the US and 1 in Europe. I said, whoa, that's amazing. So that's when I realized that there was, in fact, a job that would apply to me. You know, I would have not known, you know. And then he told me, you know, we're going to pay you. Back then, it was they were going to pay me $1,000 a day. Back then, you have to understand, I was making $1,000 a month. Okay. And I was not into money, but I'm not into money. But when somebody's telling you, you're going to make in one day what you make in 1 month. It's like, okay, I'm in, you know, and then, so I went, didn't think about the money. You know, I for 3 weeks, I did the job and everything. What it taught me is if you shoot for a movie, the way you're shooting the sequence is the reason you're telling the story. So let's say you're filming a car going from an airport to the city. Okay. Because the guy just landed and he's going to the city. There's a dialogue in the car. If it was for TV, the only thing they wanted to know is going from the airport to the town. But us in the film industry, if it's a 4-second shot or a 45-second shot, you're not going to shoot it the same way. So I'll have to, if you just go from the airport to the city, it's a boring shot. So I have to start with a plane landing, go to the terminal, get the car while driving on the highway, that timing right, like a seamless shot. And when I get to the car, I zoom into the car, then the dialogue start, and then the guy, blah, 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 blah. Then when he's done talking, I zoom out, I go behind the car and the guy goes toward the city and I see the city where he's going. So that's movie. When TV will be just to show where the damn car go. So I learned that the film pilot has a huge input on the creative part, which I love. Even as of today, I love being part of the creative. Because you're a dolly grip. You're the one moving the camera. You become the camera. And as a camera pilot, I love that. You know, like I'm the image. I'm the one. The helicopter doesn't exist anymore. So that's from that film in Venezuela. I understood all those principles. And then from that film, I decided to invest my effort, energy, money, time towards the film industry, you know, to become a film pilot.
When kind of earlier on in the story, when you first went to America, English wasn't kind of like your best language. When did English come? Was it just like a constant practice, like a lot of TV shows were in English, everything was kind of English, you kind of picked up from it? Or did you have to make a concerted effort to really kind of like become fluent in English? Obviously, when you take your aviation test, you have to have some kind of proficiency in English. So I assume it had to do something with that as well, right?
Well, I mean, the truth is when you do your FAA commercial license, the English doesn't need to be that great. Because what do? You do your commercial test, but it's 600 questions that you have to learn. So yeah, but aviation words, you know, usually basic pilots, we know wind, vent in French, you know, your weather forecast, météo, you know, it's the words are not that far apart. Helicopters, you know. So anyway, you know words that are similar in all languages. in Spanish, helicópteros, you know, it's not that far away. So I had basic, but what happened is while I was becoming a film pilot in France, I mean, from France all over the world, but not in the US, American production was starting to call me. So I slowly by slowly learned English on the street, as we say, like not at school. Remember, I'm terrible at learning stuff at school. So I'm not good to take a book and try to learn stuff. Not my thing.
Yeah, you need the real world.
100%. So then I had like an English that was kind of okay from an American perspective, which means an American guy coming to France, talking to me, that was okay with that. But I was not okay to be a French guy living in LA, which is a different perspective. Because if you come to me in France and my English shit, you're gonna tell me, oh, your English is not bad. Now, if I go to LA and you talk to me, what the fuck is that English? You know, so it was different. So then slowly by slowly, I had a bit of wordings. And then at 40 years old, that's when I made the decision to go to LA to go to the US to do the amazing American movies, to do the big action movies. I had to be in LA to be known in the US because American production, they bring their own pilots everywhere in the world because they need to have that trust relationship and to know the person, to make sure that person knows what he's doing. They will not use a local guy because they don't know if that guy knows his thing. 100%. So then that's when I said, when I moved to the US, I was 40 years old. Nobody's waiting for you. Nowhere. Okay. I only knew one guy in the US, the guy that I flew in Venezuela, Larry Blanford, that did the first Top Gun. And he told me, Fred, I will help you, but it's not going to be easy because the other pilots, they're not going to be welcome you there. And it's not going to be easy to have the producers trust you. You nobody, your English shit. You know, you don't know anything. You don't know the rules in the US. You don't know nothing. So I did my FAA license. And anyway, it was not easy. You know, my first job was in New York on the Brooklyn Bridge. I had no FAA permit. I even didn't know you needed an FAA permit. I shot the damn car 50 feet from the cars, open traffic, crazy. Don't do that at home. I'm telling you, don't do that. But it was 20 years ago, you know, and I didn't know. And then I learned and, you know, I made my mistake. And then, look in the book, I'm explaining plenty of stuff for that. I explain all the little things. The journey was not easy. I got denied for a visa. My wife was pregnant. I put all my money into the US, to LA. I was not coming back to France. One-way ticket. And I put all my effort, and at the end, I resolved all my issues. I got my visa, I got my kids, I got my license, I have proper FAA permits and all that stuff. But it was not an easy thing to do because at 40 years old, to reinvent yourself in a foreign country. But I have to say, you know, America is amazing for that because it's a cliche, but it's a true cliche. American people, they give you opportunities. Like, it doesn't matter from where you're coming from. They let you, if you have skill, you have talent, and you're a hardworking person, you will succeed in America. 1,000%. The same thing doesn't apply in Europe. Even if you know what you're doing and you're successful, the French people, they're too much judgment because of the history of what, you know, we're coming from. But in America, because you got more adventure, you know, it's a multiplex of people coming to that came to the US, you know, from Europe, from everywhere, from Ireland, from, you know, the Indians, all that stuff. It's a different. So I really had a chance, you know, so thank you, the American, for that I was able to succeed here. And I'm a happy guy here. And aviation in the US is fantastic. You know,
I love it. How many films have you shot? Do you have like any ideas, or just kind of like this all builds up and you don't think about how many?
No, there is a website called imdb.com, industry movie database. Yeah. And if you go there and you put my name, there's like 240 movies or something. So
do you have a favorite movie? Are you allowed to say like, this was my favorite, like top five or anything like that?
It's hard to say because each time I do a crazy sequence, I really love when we do like, there's a team effort for the creative part, like the Fast and Furious movie. I can contribute to the creative part and give guidance to director and give ideas. And then we do it. And I love to see that stuff on film. Michael Bay is an amazing director to work with on, his vision is insane of this world. The guy that directed The Extraction, Sam Hargrave, is an amazing director, open to creative. You know, I just did Beverly Hills Cops 4 that is not out yet. Eddie Murphy, Mark Molloy, that director is super cool, you know. And all the directors, they're in their zone. Like they're not in this planet. So you have to understand their vision, extract that, and really try to offer what you can do with the helicopter beyond what they can think, you know. It's our job to suggest that, you know. So I love that.
Have you had any interaction? I mean, there are some actors, right, that are pilots that fly. I mean, ones that come to your mind, like Tom Cruise, Harrison Ford. There's more, obviously. John Travolta, that's one that everyone thinks of. But have you had any kind of, like, interactions between other pilots just talking about aviation, talking about the helicopters? Has anyone just been like, man, that's really cool? Like, have you ever gotten anyone into helicopters, into aviation, that kind of thing?
No, for sure. But, you know, some of the actors you just listed, so some of them are extremely focused on themselves and some others are more open to aviation. So I love have a conversation with the one that are open to aviation and less about themselves, you know, because some of them, they use their image and they use aviation for their image. Some others that you name here, they're using aviation for the passion of it. With those guys, I love sharing stories. With the other ones, it's not my deal to be an actor and that stuff. So I let them be, you know. But the ones that are passionate, yes, I love it. Because they have everything, but they don't have what we have, our tremendous experience because we're professional. They would love that. Like John Travolta is so passionate about it. It's amazing to share stories with them, you know. It's always a good moment to have conversation with those guys, but some of them are more passionate than others.
Yeah. Talk about let's just say today or tomorrow, you're going to go shoot a movie. It's a very complex scene. Give me a little kind of a cliff notes of like the planning, the execution, and kind of the post-production or the post-flight. Like kind of go from how you're going to do it, how you actually do it, and then what you do afterwards.
Yeah. So usually 8-9 months before the movie is going to happen, I get the script from the director. And it's usually not a final script. It's just the storyline. And then he's telling me the idea for the aerial sequence. So then I take that, I work on it, and I tell him what's feasible, what's not feasible, how we should structure the story. I'm putting input, I'm changing a few things that we can add. Then I send back to him. Then 6 months pass by, then I get a phone call from the producer doing the show. And then he's asking me with that script now to give him a budget. So then I give him, you know, he wants to know how many days to do that piece. So I'm the one to try to find out. So to do that, it's not always easy to know how many days I need to shoot the sequence. So they usually give me what we call a storyboard on paper. And I usually take a scissor. I cut each image. I put it on the floor and I put it per day that I think we can do. You know, I do it like this. And then I tell him, okay, we need 10 days for the sequence. We need those aircraft with those pilots for the permits. That's what we should do with the FAA. It's going to take this. We need to do some training. We need to rehearse. So let's say I will tell him 3 days to rehearse training on our own and then 10 days to do the shots. So 13 days. Then I put an aerial budget for it. Then I send that back to him. Then 3-4 months goes by. And then now he's telling me, okay, Fred, we're going to start in March. So 2 months from now. And then now I'm lining up the aircraft. I'm, doing all that prep, choosing the aircraft, the crew, doing the FAA permits, you know, doing the scout. So I go physically there or my team go. We check in all the bridges. If I have to go under, if it's a night shoot, we're going to do, we go all that prep. And then we do the prep itself. So we go with the helicopters, the crew, we do the training. In the meantime, you know, I've sat down with my team. We work on everybody has input and we work as a collaboration team. And then we do the gag, you know, and when the sequence is over, then, you know, we take a champagne and,
always champagne.
No, I don't drink alcohol, but something. Yes. I never had a drop of alcohol in my life, by the way.
Oh, man. Coming from France or being a Frenchman, that's a sin.
My wife drink for me. That's fine.
Yeah. I like the champagne. I'll drink champagne for you too. So it's all good.
Yeah.
I know we're getting close to an hour. I got a couple more questions for you, but when you're in the shot, there's so many variables that can delay, right? Whether it's clouds, whether it's just weather in general, whether people get sick. How does that affect
the people that don't understand aviation or the how weather can affect everything. Like the producer wants a shot. They don't understand that. All right, there's a 50 knot. The winds are just too strong for us to shoot today. Oh, it's a beautiful day. What are you talking about? Let's get it done. How do you kind of deal with the personalities around this to get the job done?
So the older you get, so at my level and my age, people, if I say, you know, we cannot do it because of the wind, nobody's going to argue on it. The problem was more in my when I was younger, when I was like 30 years old and people were not listening to me because I was just a pilot versus now I'm coming with the reputation and the history. So in Hollywood, because people are extremely professional in the aerial world, because they've been doing aerial work for decades and they know impact, you know, there's some famous accidents that happen on a, you know, movie like Twilight Zone or other things that it's still present in people's minds. So if you say no, they're usually asking me, what will be your wind limit? Let's say there is a, you know, if we work in Chicago, for example, where it's a wind city, they will tell me, you know, what will be your limitation? And I said, it depends what we do. If we're on the lake, I can fly 35 knots, not a problem. But if it's in the city between buildings, 20 knots is a max. So I give them those numbers before we do the show. And then on the day, it's always windy over there. I mean, it's very rarely that there's no wind in Chicago, for example. And we had that problem on the movie Rampage with Dwayne Johnson. And that was between buildings, crazy wind. And I told them, you know, we had to stop. And it cost them, it was a Sunday. We only had the city 10 blocks. We owned the 10 blocks downtown Chicago for 4 hours, Sunday morning from 8 to 12. And it cost them $1 million to buy all the businesses, all the streets. You know, it's $1 million for 4 hours. That's not the cost of the production, it's just to buy everybody out. And then I told the producer, you know, it's too windy, I can't do it. And they said, no problem, Fred. We're going to do it another day. There's no question. So they rely on me to make that decision. And they know that when I tell them, they know that I'm on my max. Like I'm not the kind of guy that will, if there is a little, I think he can maybe do it, they know I'm going to do it. But if I say no, that means there is a wall and I can't do it. So it's not a problem, never a problem.
Do you, now obviously these are kind of like your minimums and kind of your kind of safeguards, but I'm guessing through this, you have to have some sort of insurance, right? Like you can't just go out there, but is there anything, does insurance guide any of this? Insurance is huge in aviation, kind of dictates who you can hire, how you can do stuff, how you can fly. Is there any difficulties with that, with this kind of job? Because you're flying way closer than anyone else flies the stuff. You're flying faster, doing crazy stuff. Like, I mean, there's no other really. It's cool, but it's like, it's people don't do this every day.
No, but so I have the same insurance broker for 20 years, first of all. So we have a relationship. Okay. So they know me, and their name is Telling Risk, by the way. They're amazing, you know, insurance company. And then the thing with insurance in general, they need to understand exactly how you do your operation. Okay. Most of the time they're very expensive because they put you in a box and they don't really understand what you're doing, but you're doing school or training, boom, you're in that box. But they don't know the way you're doing it. Okay, you do search and rescue. They put you in that box. But everybody has a different way to approach risk. They have a safety program that is different. Everybody's doing different for safety. So the way I do my film work, they know. So I invite my insurance broker on set. He can see what I'm doing. I'm trying to have a conversation with the underwriter. I say, can I talk to them? Sometimes my insurance guys say, absolutely not. But as a joke, you know, but now with my social media, they can see what I'm doing. There is no, so I'd rather work in transparency with insurance and tell them that's how I do the business. And we're super safe. We're very careful. Is there a risk? Yes, but we manage it and we have insurance to cover it. Now I don't want to use my insurance, but you know, that's where they are for. And it's expensive, but there is a transparency and they understand how we do, you know, manage safety.
Yeah. It's funny. It kind of sounds, did you ever see the movie Along Came Polly with Ben Stiller?
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like that. Like Ben Stiller, that's your insurance agent that's trying to get the guy that's jumping off mountains, that's jumping off base jumping. Yeah. So that you were that guy that insurance agents going after, trying to figure out why they're doing this. And how
it's the same with the FAA, by the way, because when we do our crazy shit, I bring the FAA to the set. I'm inviting them to the set. And I'm, because I want them to be responsible with me also. Like come to the set and see what we do and see the way we structure the job. So so they understand, because the way I see it with the FAA, we're a team. It's not them against me. I'm not me against them. I'm not trying to hide them something. I want them to know what I'm going to be doing, the way I'm doing it. I don't want them to tell me no. I want them to help me protect the public, because it's my responsibility and it's for them to make sure we do. But I want to do it as a team. I don't like when somebody says no, an inspector, and fuck off. You know, I don't like that. I always tell them, please act as a team. I'm not against you. Let's do it together. You know, so anyway.
Yeah, definitely. What's like one or two kind of scenes? I know you already shared one with a guy jumping off like 15 feet in the air, almost killing Santa Claus. A little bit different, but is there any, I guess it's a better question. Was there any time that you've been in a stunt and it's just been too much and you haven't been able to do it? It was just either got too reckless, it got too kind of out of control. Is there any kind of like mid shoot stunt that you just like absolutely could not do? Couldn't finish the job?
I mean, usually we never go to that point, because when they telling me, you know, what we're going to be doing, and let's say they want to do something crazy. But I mean, usually, first of all, I work with a stunt coordinator. So the stunt coordinator that is managing all the stunt guys and everything, I mean, I'm the aerial coordinator, is the stunt coordinator. Usually we as safe as possible, both of us. So if there is like a jump, I did a movie called The Fall Guy with, you know, Ryan Gosling. The trailer just came out yesterday. And we did some crazy stuff on that movie. And the stunt coordinator, Chris O'Hara, fantastic guy. There was a jump, the highest jump that we were supposed to do from a helicopter with a stunt guy that was going to jump, you know, like it was 150 feet. So really high. And so when we prep a sequence like that, we do it together, which means we what do you think? We should do this? And no, let's do it that way. So it's a 100% collaboration that is opened. There is no, that we're never going to do something, and the stunt guys will never put me in a corner, and I will never put them in a corner. So we never get to that point where you know, I'm going to say no, because I would have said no way before that happened. It was more back in the days when I was 30 years old, 28 years old, and then I was doing some stunt stuff without prepping much. And, you know, I did some crazy stuff on a movie called Transporter, the first one. And there was a guy hanging under the helicopter. And I mean, we did some crazy shit. And back then we were prepping like the morning off, because I didn't know any better and nobody knew any better. It was in France. And, you know, back then the stunt stuff was, let's do this. Okay, let's go. But I don't do that anymore. You know, I don't do that anymore. So I will never let that situation happen, because we will resolve it ahead of time.
Someone that is listening to this, watches your Instagram stuff, they see what you're doing. They want to do what you want to do, right? They want to do helicopters. They see the cool stuff you post. What would you recommend to them? Obviously, it's not like a cut and dry, like this is how you get here. There's many different routes they could take, but what would you recommend to someone that wants to do something you do?
So the first thing, and look, I'm not pushing for the book, because I'm making zero money with my book. Okay, it's zero. For now, I'm losing money on it, but so it doesn't matter to that. But the reason I did the book is because I wanted for the people to know how I got there. So I'm explaining everything in there. I'm just going to tell you quickly, but I would say the most important thing is if you want to be a stunt pilot, let's say a film pilot, your personality need to match that job. It's not just as a film pilot. Let's say you want to be what you're doing. I think to be the guy, to be the guy that is the pilot doing something and not just a pilot, your personality need to match whatever skill you have. Because if the personality doesn't match what you're going to be doing, you're just going to be an average person. So you have to make sure that whatever you want to be is who you really are internally. And like, you know, instinctive person versus technical person. Like for me, I'm an instinctive person. I am making decision on the spot. I have a gut feeling that I can do it. I'm convinced I can do it. I don't know why. A technical person will need to go through the protocol. He will go through the business plan, the business model. He has a list of things to do for him to do it. Me, I don't do it that way. So like I would be a terrible airline pilot. I would be a terrible jet pilot, because I know I'm not good for that. But for what I do, I'm really good at it, because my personality matched that. So I just want them to make sure that they're aligning those two elements. to be an expert. And that's the other thing. Become an expert in one machine. Okay. Don't go with five aircraft. One. Master that one. Yesterday, I went to a school, in the Independent Helicopters, upstate New York, and I did a book signing there, and I spoke to those young pilots. And there were like 30 guys. And I said, so all those guys flying on Robinson helicopter, those small ones, the two-seaters, to do the training. And I said, can you tell me who know the flight manual of the Robinson by heart? Who in this room know the flight manual by heart? Two guys on 30. And I said, you see, you guys want to be expert. You're just beginning. You should know the damn thing by heart. And I told him, 8 years ago, I had the flight manual on the helicopter that I have 17,000 hours on next to my bed. My wife was there. She confirmed that the thing, the 400 pages was next to my bed. And once in a while, I read it because we forget. So be an expert on one machine only, because it's impossible to be an expert on five aircraft. And you'll be recognized as an expert. And then if you recognize as an expert, you'll make more money. You'll have more gratification from your peers. You'll have more respect from your peers, and you'll be in demand because there's not that many experts. So try to be that expert. It doesn't matter which machine, you know, be the best in that aircraft. So I'm just telling all the pilots out there, choose and go for it, full blast, you know, and then create opportunities for yourself. You're a jet pilot. Let's say you want to work with NASA one day. Nothing's stopping you to go to NASA, try to get an appointment with the aviation people and get that relationship going. There's nothing preventing you. They're not going to come to you. Go to them. The only thing they may say is no, but it'll be on them. You'll say, I'm a young pilot, or I have 5,000 hours. My dream is to work for NASA. Can I just talk to you for 15 minutes? Can you share me your experience? Just expose yourself. Don't wait for things to come to you, because they don't. Or if they do, it'll take forever. So that's the other thing, you know, go and knock at doors. Like, if you want to be a stunt pilot, send me a message. I respond on my social media. Each of you guys, I respond, you know. Don't ask me, you know, what the weather is, of course, but ask me something legit and I'll respond to you, each of you. That's why I did the book. Plus, right, you know, all that stuff. So that would be my recommendation. Yeah.
All right, Fred. Thank you so much. Thanks for spending an hour of your time with me. I want to go ahead and give me the opportunity, or not the opportunity, but tell everyone where they can buy the book, the best place to buy it, follow you, do all kind of those social media things, and let everyone know how they can support you. And
thank you so much. So yeah, the book is called Flying Sideways, and you can get it on my social media, on Instagram. There's a link shop. You can click there. Very easy. You can also get it by Amazon. Easy to get. You can get it for Barnes & Noble. There's plenty, any library you can go, you ask them, they will get it to you. You know, that book is very easy to read. You have the QR code at the end that is really fun to do. And it's like me talking. It's like me telling the story. When you read the book, it was very important. You know, we do it that way. So it's a fun read. And it's not, by the way, it's not for helicopter people. It's for anyone that going through harsh stuff in his life to get to where he wants to be. And we all have stories to tell, but me, I just wanted to share it. It's a funny story and everything, but it's for anyone that is looking for answers or just have a fun time, you know.
I love it. Well, if it's as fun as this conversation has been, then it's going to be a great book. So I look forward to reading.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Justin.
Yeah. All right, Fred. Thank you. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. And anytime we can do another one, no worries.
Well, I'll do it. Yeah, we'll do one live on set one day. We'll talk
when
about it.
yes, we can always do that. Send me a message, because I forget. So send me a message on Instagram, Fred. Don't forget if you can, because I can always take you on set. And then you'll become part of my team, because that's the only way I can get you on set. And then you'll become part of our team. And then you can work with us for a day or two. And then you'll get paid.
Let's do it. Yeah, let's make it happen, man. That'd be great. Well, have a great day. I wish you all the best. Like I said, I'm going to go buy the book. So have a good one.
Thank you so much, Justin. Take care.
That's a wrap on the Pilot to Pilot podcast episode with Fred Knorr. Thank you so much for listening. Shout out to Fred. It was awesome having him on the podcast, sharing his story, hearing what he has done and what he did to that poor, poor Santa Claus. So I hope you enjoyed this. If you want more like this, you know, just reach out to me. Let me know who you want on the podcast, or you can email scheduling at pilotthepilothq.com. and we can go take a look at those resumes or wherever you want on the podcast. But Aviation, that's all I got for you today. Hope you're having a great day. And as always, happy flying. Pilot to Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth pays promoter a fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter, promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in a material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.